Hi, I'm Toby Sagarin. This talk is called Why Semantics? So what I'm planning to do is explain what semantic data is, show how entities and data can be modeled using a graph and with lots of examples, and how this makes it easier to integrate data sets from various sources without dealing with crazy migration headaches. And I'll introduce you to practical stuff as well, some of the open source tools that are out there to help you actually do this stuff. So I just finished the draft of a book for O'Reilly. And this happened to me very frequently. Of course, I tell people I finished writing a book draft, and they say, oh, what's it about? And I say, oh, it's about the practical things that have come out of semantic web research. And they look at me for a little bit, and they always make the same joke. Oh, so you're writing fiction now. It was funny the first 10 times, and then so we suggested, you know how O'Reilly has those line-drawn animal covers, that we should have some sort of mythical animal on it, like a Pegasus, because a flying pig would be a little too ridiculous. So because semantic web is such a loaded term, I want to give a little idea of what this talk is not about. It's not going to be a Tim Berners-Lee style presentation where I tell you how in just a few minutes the semantic web's going to exist and it's going to be awesome, and we're going to have intelligent agents negotiating with our dentists so that we don't have to do it ourselves. And nor am I going to tell you that this is the inevitable future of the web. This is not a speculative fiction type talk. This is about what exists today and why you should care. Or even if you don't care, stuff you should know in case someone else starts talking to you about it and you can fight back. Another thing I don't really want to get into is all the technical details of RDF, XML, Sparkle, Girdle, and hundreds of other formats that the efforts have come up with. You can go read about that stuff yourself. It's been a major disappointment to me, actually, and one reason why I decided to write a book about this was that all of the semantic web books we'd seen so far focused on these on the details of how the file formats work, and that's all really available in the specs if that's what you want. I'm not going to try and convince you that my way, this way, is the best, because I am going to, a lot of people get in the situation where they learn about something new and then suddenly they want to apply that to everything. And semantic data is actually like that for some people. So I'm going to explain how it might work better than some of the things that you've been doing that might make you angry, because no one likes to be wrong. But don't think of it that way. This is another tool which can be used in certain cases. And finally, this isn't a bunch of hypotheticals. There's actually money to be made by knowing this stuff. I'll give you a couple of examples. So Yahoo has actually, they have all their separate content sites like local, movies, travel, kids, and the information there changes fairly frequently, and they want to be able to have a flexible modeling platform. So they've recently actually started moving all their backends to semantic stores, which we'll talk about soon. And the other thing that happened is that one of the largest web consulting companies in the United States actually called us one day because they heard we'd written this book, and apparently they had managed to sell a project doing semantics web stuff to a major media conglomerate and had no idea how to do it, and and so wanted us to teach them. So. If only my sales skills were that good, right? Okay, so and one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk was that I feel like there have been a few things that have been happening online recently that that make me think that, you know, there's sort of some traction behind this idea. This guy, Steve Yee, used to work at Amazon, now he works at Google, and he has a very popular programming blog. So he posted this thing called the Universal Design Pattern. And it was a very, very, very long article, but all it really said was that sometimes you can't come up with the right class model or XML data structure, and you should just have objects with key-value pairs. And a lot of people jumped on this and pointed out that this is exactly what semantic web standards are about, except they actually like take it even further and make it more useful. And so he later updated the article and thanked the people for pointing that out. And what was cool is that he'd sort of come to this conclusion without even knowing that other people were already working on it. So, and this keeps happening. I've noticed this in a lot of different blogs. The other thing I saw, this was just a couple of weeks ago, this example from a blog called Read Write Web called Is the Relational Database Doomed? It was actually kind of a silly article about how everyone was going to use column stores like Amazon SimpleDB. But again, what was interesting was the commenters. One of them pointed out that there's a graph database called Neo4j. This was sort of the new one of the new things that was happening. And the other one pointed out that he was talking about scaling to size of data, but not scaling to complexity. And that's what semantics takes on. So this is cool to me because people are really starting to talk about this stuff and realizing that there is stuff here that they need. Okay. So I'm going to start by talking about traditional data modeling. There are many ways to model data, and some of them are very well studied and mature. The performance of relational databases has been tuned for decades to be amazing. So first I'm going to look at data modeling techniques we usually use and show how they can break down when faced with things like rapidly changing requirements. Okay, so this is the simplest kind of data set. One almost everyone familiar with is tabular data. It's kept in a table like an Excel spreadsheet or an HTML table or whatever. Here we have a table of restaurants. You've got addresses, cuisine, price, days it's open. People love this data in a table because it's easy to store and sort and print. And people who aren't coders will do incredible things with Excel. They'll like build multiple sheets that are all linked together because they really, really want to resist learning how to code ever. And but data in this way has obvious limitations, right? You just look at the last column. I've just sort of crammed all the days in there. And this is fine if all you're planning on doing is reading the table. But what if I wanted to put opening hours in there as well, right? You can still read it from the table, but you can't, say, do a query on a large set of restaurants to find out which one's going to be open late on Friday. And similarly, a database for retailers might have separate records for its customers and its products. And people will go, like I said, very far. They'll build relational data within Excel, but then these are usually way too complicated, and only the person who built the spreadsheet in the first place can ever use it. So, of course, you've seen schemas like this before, probably. Relational database is a very fast, powerful way of storing large sets of data where the data is well understood and the usage patterns are predictable. And that's important. So it essentially allows you to join multiple tables in a standardized way. So here we've moved the hours out of the restaurant column, out of its own column, and put it into a separate table. And we fill it with data. So now, obviously, we can write a SQL query to find out what restaurants are open late on a Friday night. So this is as far as most people get, most developers get with data modeling, but it's great because it's still way, way more useful than a spreadsheet. But data integration across the web is characterized by these rapidly changing types of data and never quite knowing what will be available when. So as a simple example, we have a restaurant database up and running, and then we get another database of bars with additional information that isn't in our schema. At some of these bars are actually the bar area of the restaurants. So in this case, it shows that the Marquis de Salade, in addition to being a French restaurant, is also a bar with a DJ that serves martinis. And as of right now, we have two separate databases, but it's certainly possible that someone might want to query across them. For example, to find a good restaurant to get a French meal and get martinis. So I'm going to explain a few things that I've seen people do when faced with the situation. One thing that people do is just add more columns to one of the tables and sort of just keep mostly empty. That's what we call a sparse data table. And sparse data is actually one of the biggest problems with putting data in tables, because you can end up with lots and lots of empty cells, wasted space, and it's not optimal for your queries either. So it's also okay for now because we only have five columns, but you can imagine more data coming along, like maybe one of these is also a live music venue. Another thing people sometimes do is just like sort of create this link table where they take their bar table, they've got their restaurant table, they figure out which ones are the same, and they stick a table in between them so that tell you that the restaurant and the bar are actually the same thing. So this works, and it makes the query possible that we wanted to do, but it also introduces a problem that all the data is duplicated. We have We have names and addresses, et cetera, in both tables. And well, we just have a link telling us they're the same place. So if you wanted to query by address, you'd need to look at both tables. Also, the type of food is attached to restaurant type and not to its bar type. So adding and updating is much more complicated now. Finally, this is probably the best approach, is to recognize that a place is separate from its function. So we sort of create a venue table instead and put the bars and restaurants pointing to the venue. And then you can do all the queries that you want to be able to do. It also solves the issue that if we discover different functions, we can create more tables. So this seems to solve the issues, but the problem now is that our data is still in our old format, and we need to migrate it. And also, all the queries were written assuming a certain structure, so they have to be changed as well. So a whole discipline of software engineering emerged to take care of this problem, using techniques like stored database procedures, and ORMs, to hide as much of its underlying schema from the business logic as possible. In addition to having to migrate as data evolves, another problem one runs into with relational databases that cover a lot of different kinds of data is that the schemas can get insanely complicated. Like this here is a small section of a CRM software schema. And a CRM software is a small portion of all the operations of a business. Something like SAP, which does enterprise resource planning, has thousands of tables and whole consulting companies that understand the schema. So this brings us to the question, is it possible to define a schema so it's flexible enough to handle a wide variety of changing data while maintaining a certain level of readability? So this, I'm not suggesting that this is actually a good schema, but what I am saying is it is a way to create a schema that could be open to new venue purposes and custom and with custom fields so that we've sort of lost the concept of bars and restaurants entirely, and we just have venues and we can apply properties to them like what cuisine they have, what price, what specialty cocktail, et cetera. And as we get more information about different functions for these venues, we can just add we can add them to the fields list, and then add the data into the properties list without having to change the schema. Surprisingly, this is actually what a lot of people end up doing in these cases, even though it's definitely not considered good database design. So I'm going through all these ridiculous contortions for a good reason. So this is to get you to the idea of semantic data. Now, all data has semantics. All data expresses connections between things. And because you know how to read a table or a relational schema, you can figure out what those connections are. When I say semantic data, I mean that you make the semantics explicit. Okay, so this subject predicate object is called a triple. And it forms the fundamental building block of semantic representations. You can think of triples as representing a simple linguistic statement with each element corresponding to a piece of grammar that would be used to diagram a short sentence. Generally, the subject and triple corresponds to an entity, something thing for which we have a concept like a person or a place, but also periods of time, ideas, and even relationships. So our predicates are a property of the entity to which they're attached. So a person's name or birth date, or a business's stock symbol or a mailing address are all potential predicates. And objects fall into two classes, either entities that can be the subject of other triples, or literal values like strings or numbers. So if we apply this general model to the restaurant data I was showing you, we can see that we've turned this into a list of triples. So S1, we've sort of just made up IDs for these here, but S1 has a cuisine deli, has a price of one, is the name Dalai Lama, et cetera. So we've taken all those properties and we've now flattened this out and made it completely generic. Also, what we're able to do is down lower you can see that we have downtown and Wellington S6 refers to downtown and is contained by S7 in Wellington. And we've also specified that one of the restaurants, the Peking Inn, is located in downtown Wellington. So we can not only specify properties for objects, we can also link them together. And the easier way to view this is as a graph. So the triple format is great for machines, but it can be a little tedious for humans to read. So often people like to look at their semantic data as a graph like this. So you can see that S2 representing Peking Inn has the name Peking Inn, cuisine Chinese, but it's also located in downtown, which is contained by Wellington. So it's actually pretty easy to take a bunch of triples and turn it into a visual representation of a graph. There are programs that will do this for you automatically. And so for this reason, databases that store semantic data can be called both triple stores or graph databases. So I also just want to point out that our original spreadsheet here contains semantics. It's just that they're, in this case, rather than being explicit, like in our subject predicate object model, they are implied by the layout of the data. So you know that because Chinese is in the row Peking Inn and the column cuisine, that means Peking Inn has the cuisine Chinese. And you know that because you know how to read a table, not because it's directly specified by this. And when you write a parser for a CSV file, that's exactly what you're doing. You're explaining the semantics of a table to the machine. So semantic data just skips that step entirely. I just wanted to show you a couple more examples so you could see how easy it is to store, to think about data as a graph. So this is a celebrities diagram. Wonderful thing about famous people is that other people are always talking about what they're doing, particularly when it's completely unexpected. So for example, this is the graph around Britney Spears. Even from this very small section of her life, it's clear that there's a lot of different things you might want to say about a celebrity. It's almost comical to think that you could design in advance a schema that would capture everything one would want to say about a celebrity. So, and this graph has already failed to include things like favorite nightclubs and estranged children and angry head shavings and cosmetic surgery controversies. Places are also really interesting because there's so much data about cities and countries available from various sources, and they also provide the context for so many different things. Unfortunately, they can be difficult to model as well. The hierarchy of places differs across the world. In San Francisco is in California. In the United States, every city is within a state. Every city is actually also within a county, except in a couple of states. So that can make it really difficult to model if you're trying to choose your schema up front. In this case, we can just say San Francisco is in California, which is in the United States. And we can also say things about the population, about the location, and so on. Lest you think that semantic data modeling is all about entertainment and celebrities, this picture shows you an example with a little more gravitas, which is business data about this is Microsoft, Bill Gates is the chairman and the director of Berkshire Hathaway. We have political contribution data that, I actually have a huge data set of old stuff like this that we've gotten from various places and integrated together. People talk a lot about the importance of semantics for integration, but so far I've just shown you how you can create and extend separate data silos. Expressing your data this way actually really shines when you want to take graphs from two different sources and then merge them together by combining the nodes. And that can greatly increase the expressiveness of queries. So let's say we've got the business data set, and then we managed to get this places data set. If we can figure out that the Seattle in this one means the same thing as the Seattle in this one, and I'll get to that later because that's sort of a fairly important detail, then we can merge them together. And we've greatly increased the expressive possibilities. Now I can search for software companies that are only in cities of more than 300,000 people or whatever it is. You could imagine with the other data I had, with the political contributions, you could figure out if people donate to politicians in their area or just of their of their political leanings. So the reason for all this is that I feel like the web has given us this idea of perpetual beta, where we build applications, we put them up, but we know we're going to keep working on them. And so this shift has sort of like led to this huge interest in scripting languages, like what were formerly called scripting languages, like Python and Perl and Ruby, because the ease of getting something up and running with minimal upfront design and the ease of quick iterations gives these languages an advantage over over the languages which were designed for more traditional approaches to software. But most frameworks that use these languages still rely on relational databases for storage. So they do require a lot of upfront data modeling and create this lock-in where, although you can change the UI quickly, it's much more difficult to change the sort of data that you can access quickly. So I think we should be thinking about, do we believe this for code, so why not for data? Why can't data evolve quickly as well? So hopefully I've given you some ideas of the selfish reasons for caring about semantic data. The vision of the semantic web, though, was always that data could be shared as easily as text can be shared on the regular web. Now, we're lucky that people can say things ambiguously, and we can read them and interpret what they mean. The semantic web, we have to be a lot more specific, obviously. So I'm just going to talk about that for a little bit. So obviously, people care about sharing data, right? This is a screenshot from Programmable Web showing thousands of APIs that people have made so that you could access the data within their sites. I think it's so awesome that people do this. It's one of those things that, you know, you don't even really expect, because why are people so eager to share their data? But they do. They are. So the only problem right with this is you have to learn all of these APIs separately. Even if it's a clean XML REST API, you still have to learn what the fields are, how they're laid out within the XML. And one of the hopes, and I say hopes because it hasn't happened yet, is to make this process much easier. So I use data from the US Dietary Association. It's cool because you get all this great information about every food product that's sold in the United States has to be in this database with all the nutritional information. And they let you download it, which is nice too, but it's in many, many, many separate text files, all of which are linked together according to a schema. So you have to download it all, set up a database that matches that schema, load them all in. And that's sort of the initial setup cost for doing this is very high, which is fine if that's all you're doing. But if you're trying to work with data from dozens of different sources, it can be a pain to try and figure this out each time. On the other hand, there's a service called GeoNames, which it offers its data in a semantic format. When you get it, it's all subject, predicate, object, just like this. And the specification of the fields is contained within the data itself. So you can see that the subjects are IDs, and the predicates describe a relationship, and the object is either the name, a name or a number, or another object. So in this list, we have one country, the 382, which is France, and then Alsace has a parent feature of France, so you know that Alsace is contained within France. And what this gets us to is that metadata is data, and it can be delivered along with the data to make it easier to interpret. And so, of course, what predicates mean might be ambiguous, but we'll get to that in just a moment. This is what the data really looks like. It doesn't come as a table. It comes in these different serialization formats. The original one was called RDF-XML, which it's an XML format, so it doesn't look pretty on slides. And it's also kind of irritating to read, although easy for a machine to pass. This is the N3 serialization, which is meant to be it's meant to be both easy to pass and easy for people to read. So you can see that that we have one of the IDs from GeoNames. Its name is France. Its population is 64 million, and the Alsace feature as well. So if you look at this, you notice that we define the prefix geo at the top and then stick it on a bunch of the predicates. So we define geo as as a predicate pointing to a certain URL, which is called the namespace. And at that URL, you'll actually go, you'll find a definition of the namespace, what predicates you're allowed to use and what they mean. So this is how we know that we're using the same predicates and what they mean. The idea is that different data providers, if they all agreed on these namespaces, could all share data and it would be interpretable and integratable across the web. Unfortunately, this hasn't happened yet. There's still a lot of people trying to claim to be the namespace for certain things. And this is actually one of the biggest problems with the true semantic web. So this is a short list of ones that have become relatively widely used. This is from the new Yahoo Build Your Own Search Service API, which consumes semantic data. And it recognizes things like Dublin Core, Shock, Freebase, and FOF. Dublin Core is actually one that's really widely used. It's a metadata format for describing documents, who authored them, when they were written, etc. And that actually seems to be fairly common in universities and stuff like that to mark up data using the standard form. So in addition to knowing if we're using the same predicates, we also have the problem to know if we're using the same subjects and objects. And this is a challenge in data integration no matter what you do, and the semantic web community is actually trying to address it. So in our previous example, we merged Seattle from two different graphs. But Seattle can refer to at least three different things. And we'd rather not accidentally state that Microsoft is located on a battleship. And even in this case, Seattle, referring to three things, Seattle itself is a very, very unusual word. And stuff like, there's a place in Kansas called Center, which would obviously come up with far more different things that can be called that. So a lot of people, when they start trying to deal with integrating data sets, try to merge things on names, and they always get themselves into trouble. So the semantic web approach is to use URIs which are unambiguous to identify things. In the previous example with the geonames, you saw that we had this URI which referred to France, and another URI which refers to Alsace. So this way we know when someone uses that URI, they're referring to France, the country, and not anything else that's called France. So the problem that you get into then is that there are a lot of different URIs that can mean France. Some people use geonames, some people use DBpedia, some people use Freebase, and there are probably dozens of others too. These are just the ones that I know about. So this is another area where the semantic web faces challenges in trying to achieve its true mission. One of the proposed solutions is to use this same as links, like you see here. We've specified that the geonames 382 is the same as DBpedia France and is the same as Freebase France. And the idea is that over time, if enough people do this, we'll actually have connections between all these things, and we'll be able to know when someone talks about the DBpedia France, that also means they're talking about the geonames France. But you know, all of this is still speculative and a long way off, but it would be totally cool if it can actually be done. Okay, so I've mentioned a few times that we can do extremely broad queries across these graphs. So now I want to show you a little bit about what queries look like in a graph database. My hint for graph database performance is that graph databases actually tend to perform better than relational databases only in cases where you're querying across many, many different kinds of data, which would require maybe dozens of joins within a relational database. Graph databases perform much worse when you're trying to get lots of data out of one type. So we'll go back to the celebrity graph, which we'll use as an example for the query. So the simplest ways to think about queries in a graph is as a subgraph. You want to figure out a pattern that you want to match with pieces of it missing, basically. So in this case, the only node that's really specified is the Justin Timberlake node. The other ones here are relationship, person, movie. They all have question marks after them, which I'm using to indicate that they're variables. But we've also matched to one literal name, Crossroads. And what I'm looking for is the name of person one. So what I'm looking for is the name of person one, given that person one starred in a movie with the name Crossroads and was in a relationship with Justin Timberlake. And this is what it looks like when you convert this particular graph to triples in a query language called Sparkle. And Sparkle looks a lot like SQL, with the noticeable exception that there's no from clause because there are no tables. So once you've removed the notion of tables, all you have is you specify the variables you want and the pattern, the graph pattern that you're looking for. So the example shows this graph pattern as a set of triples. We put question marks in front of things that are variables. And the ones, if we can either specify a real ID or specify a string that we want to match to. We can also do more here, like add filters that specify the relationship started after 1999, or whatever other filters you want to add. They have all kinds of filters, like regular expressions, and you can do math within the filtering. But unfortunately, it's all done post hoc, so the performance isn't that high. And finally, another cool thing is that you don't actually even have to specify the predicates if you don't want to. They can be variables themselves. In this case, maybe you don't know the connection between two things, but you suspect they have a connection, or maybe you just want to get everything associated with something else. So in this example, I'm selecting name and role, where there's actually a typo on the slide, but person has name, person has some role in some movie, and the movie's name is Crossroads. So this is something you definitely can't do in SQL, just ask for everything connected to this thing. And what you get back from a SQL query is always a set of bindings. Sometimes from certain systems they come back as JSON, like you see here, where every variable that you've asked for in the select clause becomes bound to a particular name or role or whatever. So in this case we can see that Tamara Davis directed Crossroads. So all that's well and good, but it's still theory right now. I promise in this talk we'd talk about some practical aspects. Ooh, 5 minutes? I'll go fast. Okay. So I've actually seen this schema in several places that I've worked at or visited. Basically, people try to shoehorn a graph database into a relational database. I don't know if this has happened to any of you. I'd advise you not to do it. There's no performance that can possibly happen once you design your schema this way. So there are a bunch of different systems designed from the ground up to store semantic data. This one is called Sesame. You can download a WAR file, stick it on Tomcat. It works right out of the box with this web interface. You could download RDF data like the geonames I showed you earlier, upload it directly into it, and it has a Sparkle interface built right in. So you can immediately start using it, immediately start putting data into it without it doing any schema design at all. Just whatever data you can find, you can put into it. It's a query result. Sorry, I'm going fast now. I wanted to talk quickly about Exhibit 2. This is a really nice JavaScript library that you can drop into any HTML page and browse semantic data. So if you can point it directly at a Sesame instance or at a JSON file. Because you've put all the semantics in the data itself, it makes it really easy to just say, okay, I want to add a filter on discipline. There's no server-side programming for any of this. This shows some MIT Nobel Prize winners. And you can just add a facet to filter on discipline. And it also works with maps. This is a map of pollution in Spain, also done with Exhibit. So despite the fact that the semantic web faces some challenges that I've pointed out, there's actually been a whole lot of data been put online in these semantic formats. So I have a few slides here that might be of interest, just to give you a taste of what's out there. This is from the Linking Open Data website. You can go there if you want to get lists of all the of all the RDF that's online. Hi5 publishes data in faux format, so this is a this is called Friend of a Friend, and this is me. I only have one friend on Hi5. It's popular in India, but not in the U.S. And you can see that there are different predicates like my name and my birth date and stuff like that, all embedded in this file. Geonames, which I showed you before. MusicBrainz, which is a free database that was set up in response to Gracenote going private. Everyone got really mad. They made a free one. And they also publish the data in RDF, and they provide this this Sparkle query interface, so you can go query for this. What I'm showing here is a query of everything that Madonna's done. And in the financial sector, a lot of countries are now requiring that companies publish in a format called XBRL. It's not 100% compatible with RDF, but it's meant to be extensible, and it uses these names, a similar kind of namespace and semantic predicates to specify different things. So I've actually built a parser that turned XBRL into RDF. It wasn't very difficult. For the last bit, I just wanted to talk a bit about what the W3C has been saying and what I agree with. So the semantic web's not a thing. It won't come into existence on some given day. It's a collection of standards, it's a set of tools, and most importantly, it's a community. And unfortunately, the W3C has continued to present this giant monolithic stack. And when we have that, we'll have the semantic web. I've hopefully shown useful semantic applications using the web of data can be built today. So we have these proven concepts that have been around for ages. Then we have sort of what we talked about today. The view of the semantic web as a monolithic thing really misses the point that semantic technologies are available now and you can use them, and they've been codified in well-designed components that can be included in applications right now. And this is where I always get myself into trouble, because we don't really know if we're ever going to get there, because what they need is for people to start using the lower stuff first, really. And that's it. Thank you.